Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Prison Pipeline. I'm Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. We seek to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safe, healthy, and just society. COVID-19 continues to wreak havoc within our prisons. Corrections facilities in the U.S. have been a public health nightmare for many years, so it's really no surprise. The John Jay College of Criminal Justice's Center on Media, Crime, and Justice has been holding a series of webinars for journalists on the topic of justice and the pandemic, confronting COVID-19 in correctional health care, the courts, and law enforcement. We're going to hear some audio from that now. First up, here's Nazgul Gagnoush, Ph.D. She's a senior research analyst with the Sentencing Project.
Hi, everyone. So I'm a senior researcher at the Sentencing Project. We're a research and advocacy based organization, based in DC. And recently, I have been up to a couple things that are relevant to our discussion today. So I worked with Dr. Carlos Franco Paredes, who's speaking later today, and we put together an analysis that we published in the journal Lancet Infectious Diseases about the level of decarceration that's happened so far in prisons, jails, immigration detention centers around the country, and I'll share with you some of those results. And I also recently have been working with my colleagues at the Drug Policy Alliance to bring together medical experts and public health experts to raise their voices in recommending much more dramatic decarceration than has happened so far. And this is a letter that we're going to be sharing with the COVID advisory board that the President-elect Biden has put together, and that should be coming out in the next day or two. And I'm just going to share my email address with you here so that if you're not on our email list at the Sentencing Project, feel free to email me and I can add you, or just go on our website and get added. And I'd be happy to share some of these materials with you. So I'm going to share my screen with you because I want to show a couple of slides. Let's see. All right, here we go. So I'm going to talk to you about why, if we really want to meaningfully decarcerate during this pandemic, we have to be willing to scale back sentences for violent crimes. And I'm going to tell you about why that makes sense from a criminological perspective, given that people that have especially served long sentences for violent crimes are at a very low risk of recidivating when they're released. And I'm also going to emphasize this population because of how much of an impact it would have on our levels of incarceration. And because this population, especially older people in prison that have served substantial prison terms, are especially at high risk of serious illness or death from COVID. So let's get started. So this is a chart that probably many of you are familiar with, which shows the growth in the prison population in the United States. And this is just prisons. It doesn't include people in jails. And you can see that our problem of mass incarceration is a relatively recent one that started in the 1970s, and that we've made some progress, which you can begin to notice in the recent years, of reducing the overall prison population. And so in particular, the prison population increased by about 500% in the last four decades. And then since 2009, it's been declining. And by the end point shown here, there was a 9% reduction. Since between 2018 and 2019, there was another 2% reduction. So really, we've made a turn after nearly consistent growth in the prison population for four decades. We're in a very different climate now of much more willingness to reconsider prison sentences and lengthy prison sentences. But we've just barely begun to make a dent into this. And that's where we were basically when the pandemic hit us and our correctional institutions. So I want to point out here, just as background, that when we look at the growth in incarceration levels, I think it makes sense to ask, well, how does this relate to changes in crime rates? And what's important to realize is that crime rates in the United States are about half the level they used to be at in the 1990s when they reached their peak levels. In most urban areas, if you look, and around the country, homicide rates are about half the level that they used to be at in the mid-90s. But on the other hand, we continue to grow our incarceration levels until 2009 when things finally started to turn around. So some people might think about that as an obviously problematic thing. Some people might think about that as, well, it's because of the increase in incarceration levels that we've reduced crime rates. But analyses that have looked at this question at the state level, and especially that have looked at this internationally, have shown that the United States has not been alone in experiencing an uptick in crime rates in the 1970s, 80s, until the 90s, and then a dramatic decline in crime rates since then. There's about two dozen other countries that you can look at that follow the exact same pattern. But the United States is exceptional in coming up with this problem of mass incarceration that as a solution to our crime problem. The crime uptick that we experience, and we've yet to undo it. So why have we made so little progress in reducing incarceration levels, given the more welcoming climate for reform that we have now? And I think that the answer to this lies with the answer to this question, which is what is the proportion of the prison population that's serving time for a drug offense? I want you to, the audience here, I would love for you to think about what your answer is to this question. What percentage of people that are in prison do you think are there because of a drug conviction as their most serious offense? So think about it for a second. I really want you to have a number before I tell you. And okay, so, and the actual number is 18%. When you look at people in prison, 18% of them have a drug conviction as their most serious offense. Half of the prison population are there for a violent conviction, and about another roughly 17% are there for property crimes, and the rest are there for public order offenses. So when we look at who's in prison, if we just think about scaling back and reducing prison terms for people convicted of nonviolent crimes, we can't make a big enough dent into mass incarceration. And I just do want to add a footnote to this to say that a lot of people are in prison because of the drug war that aren't included in my 18% figure. And that's because, we have limited access to drug treatment, and a lot of people going to prison commit their crimes in order to sustain addictions or under the influence of drugs or alcohol. And had they had treatment, we might have been able to divert them from that route. In addition to that, a lot of people on probation or parole supervision for a more serious offense get knocked back into prison if they're found to have drugs in their system or in their possession, even in states where, for example, medical or marijuana might be legalized. This can send someone back to prison, but they would be counted as being there for their most serious underlying conviction. So just I promise I'm going to show you fewer graphs in a few minutes, but just a little bit more in terms of the data. This is a chart that shows you the growth in the prison population broken down by offense type. And this is the number of people in prison for violent crimes, for drug crimes, and for property crimes. And you can see that the violent crime number, the line is much higher because there are a lot more people in prison for a violent conviction. And then the lines for drug and property crimes are lower. And this analysis is to show you how much we've reduced the prison population for each of these conviction types. We've made the most progress in reducing the number of people in prison for a drug conviction. We've made also considerable progress in reducing the number of people in prison for property crime, but we've been very modest in scaling back the number of people in prison for a violent crime. And that has a lot to do with the very lengthy prison sentences that people are serving for violent convictions. So I promised that I would share with you the analysis that I did with Dr. Franco Paredes about how much we've reduced incarceration levels during the pandemic. And here it is. And this is actually a version that was reproduced in an analysis that was done by the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. This was an analysis that was called, this report was called Decarcerating Correctional Facilities During COVID-19. And I recommend taking a look at that as a resource. Emily Wang was a co-chair of the committee that put that analysis together. And so what you can see here is that the number of people in state prisons, this is working with the best data that we have in terms of the beginning and endpoints. Number of people in state prisons declined by 4% during the pandemic. The number in federal prisons declined by 10.5%. And actually, since then, there's been more of a decline. So there's been about a 14% decline in the federal prison population during the pandemic. That's doing much better than the state prison population, but keep in mind that that's within the context of the federal prison population growing by 600% between 1980 to 2019. So there's really still quite a ways to go. The number of people in jails has declined by about 22%, but in many jurisdictions, they've begun to reverse that trend and increase their populations since making the declines that happened early on in the pandemic. And immigration detention facilities have reduced their populations by about 44%. So overall, when you put all these numbers together, what we found is that there's been an 11% reduction in the incarcerated population in the United States during the time of the pandemic. And we see this as insufficient. And I want to share with you this overview of a report that I produced at the Sentencing Project recently that was called The Next Step. And it tries to make a case for why we need to scale back sentences for violent crimes and identifies some jurisdictions around the country that have made some progress towards this goal. And so here are some examples. Remember, I promised fewer graphs, so here we are. So on the top left is a picture of District Attorney Larry Krasner and State Senator Sharif Street. And so I want to just give you a quick overview of some of the reforms that the folks pictured here have undertaken or are pursuing. So DA Krasner has moved to reduce sentencing plea offers that are given to people that are being resentenced who were convicted as juveniles and going below what the state has provided in its sentencing guidelines in certain cases, and instructed his prosecutors to not always bring the heaviest homicide charge that they can in a case, but to consider really what's appropriate for individual cases. Because if you bring a first degree homicide charge in a case in Pennsylvania, that's going to carry a life without parole sentence if you get that conviction. State Senator Sharif Street has been an advocate for a second look bill that actually is going through the DC Council. And the second look bill in Pennsylvania is more modest, but allows for people sentenced to life without parole to petition a court for resentencing after they've served a considerable portion of their lives in prison. On the right is Brian Stevenson, who's successfully argued several cases reducing the use of juvenile life without parole sentences in the United States. On the bottom right is Rick Ramish, who, when he was head of corrections in Colorado, limited the use of solitary confinement in that state to a maximum of 2 weeks and only for serious violations of prison rules like acts of violence. On the bottom left is Jack Wilson. He's a defense attorney in California, and he's advocating there for a bill that was passed in California to scale back the felony murder bill, the felony murder law there, so that fewer people would get sentences of 25 years to life under the law there. And in the middle is pictured a group of women that are part of Hearts for Inmates. It's a South Carolina-based advocacy organization. And they are advocating for scaling back the truth in sentencing requirement in that state from 85 to 65%. So meaning that after someone has served 65% of their sentence, they're eligible for release rather than 85%. And that's modeled in part after a reform that was implemented in Mississippi to scale back that state's truth in sentencing requirement. So these are just a couple examples of efforts that we see around the country to recognize that we have overshot, in terms of sentences, and in particular, the lengths of sentences for violent crimes. So I wanted to show you this picture here of a group of individuals that were released from prison in Maryland as a result of the Unger versus Maryland case in 2012. There have been now over 200 people released as a result of that decision in Maryland. If it weren't for this case, which was focused on problematic jury instructions during the time of their conviction, almost all of these individuals would surely still be incarcerated because the parole process in Maryland is so broken that hardly anybody is released there. And I think that this is a notable picture because you can see that these are elderly people. You can see that they're disproportionately men. They're overwhelmingly in this picture African-American, and that's true for most of the people serving life sentences in Maryland. And I think all of this goes to show a couple things. There are a couple things you can see from this. One of them is that...
I'm sorry to interrupt. Can you wrap it up in about a minute? And that's because Ms. Shubik Richards has...
Definitely, I can. So, as elderly people, most people that have served long sentences for violent crimes are at very low recidivism rates. People age out of crime after they leave their mid 20s, and so they're very low risk of recidivating. And as disproportionately people of color, I think it shows the challenge that we face in getting the broader public to realize the importance of scaling back penalties for these kinds of offenses. And so here, I just wanted to conclude by showing you and giving you access to this website that we created at the Sentencing Project as part of our campaign to end life imprisonment. And what we advocate for is greater recognition that long sentences are not effective deterrents. They are incapacitating people who are no longer a public safety risk and preventing us from making more effective investments in public safety.
That was Nazgul Ghannouch, PhD, a senior research analyst at the Sentencing Project. She was speaking on a webinar entitled Weighing Public Safety and Public Health that was sponsored by the John Jay College of Criminal Justice's Center on Media, Crime, and Justice as part of its Justice and the Pandemic webinar series. You're listening to Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now let's hear from Claire Shubik Richards, JD. She's the executive director of the Pennsylvania Prison Society.
So what we found when we went out to see if counties were in fact heeding the Supreme Court's directive is that yes, by and large, they were. So then we wanted to ask a very similar question to the question that the Sentencing Project was asking. How are they choosing to decarcerate? And are there longer term lessons that may continue on from the pandemic? And so we called a selection of judges in both urban and rural counties to ask them, how did you go about this unprecedented change? Like the rest of the country, in the Commonwealth, there's been a 25% reduction in the number of people in county jails. 8,000 fewer people are incarcerated today than there were in February. And we wanted to know, how did this come about? How did judges make these decisions? How did jail officials make these decisions? And were any of these decisions things that might continue on past the pandemic? And I think we were particularly struck by our conversation with Judge Clark. First of all, because Allegheny County took this so seriously and worked so collaboratively together. I'm going to contrast that to the city where I currently live. I used to live out in Pittsburgh, but now I live in Philly, where we have a number of very dedicated members of our criminal justice community. But the degree of collaboration that was achieved in Allegheny proves elusive for us here. And so as you might see, if I go over to Allegheny here, what you're going to see over here in Philadelphia, though good, is not as dramatic progress. So the first thing was just the degree of dedication and collaboration and resources that Allegheny put into this. For example, getting laptops for all of the public defenders and making sure that hearings could go on remotely, really commandeering the resources and making this a priority. The other thing that was really remarkable to us in our conversation with Judge Clark was in our petition with the ACLU to the Supreme Court, we had asked the court to think about incarcerated people based on their legal status. So as most of you know, in a county jail, a certain number of people are there pre-trial. They've not been convicted of a crime and they're being held while they await trial. In Pennsylvania, even more so than in other states, there are a certain number of people that are in on sentences. In most states, you're only going to be in a county jail for a sentence of 1 year or less. In Pennsylvania, that's 2 years or less. And then there's another group of people that are in because they've failed to pay fines and fees. They're in because they violated terms of community supervision. And we had asked the Supreme Court in our petition, in part, to look at people incarcerated by their legal status. And we had a hierarchy. Okay, people who've been convicted of a crime are more likely to need to be in prison than people who are in awaiting trial. And perhaps the court could order the release of people in awaiting trial. What was fascinating to us when we spoke to the judge and her fellow stakeholders in Allegheny County, the county manager, the county executive, people from the defenders, was that they actually looked at people not necessarily from their legal status, but from their criminal history, their propensity to be a public safety risk if they were on the street, and their medical vulnerability. So really asking related questions, but different questions than we had anticipated that they would be asking. So the first thing that we did back in March and April was we looked to see if people could be released, if people could get out of this dangerous situation. The second thing we did was for people that are staying in, we wanted to get a sense of what the Commonwealth, both the State Department of Corrections and the 62 county jails would be doing to mitigate the spread of the virus on the inside. So what you see here, and this is all on our website, which I hope Kati may put up www.prisonsociety.org. This is our COVID-19 landing page. What you see here is our map tracking the spread of the virus in the prisons and jails throughout the Commonwealth. Right now, there has been viral spread in all 23 state prisons, and at last count, when I counted just before getting on this conference call, 31 of the 62 county prison facilities had reported that the virus had breached the prison walls. As I mentioned earlier, we serve as a support for families of incarcerated people who are working to stay connected to their loved ones on the inside. So in addition to publishing this map, which we hope is a resource for journalists, researchers, and family members wanting to know what's happening in the prison where their loved one is incarcerated. And you can see here, I'm just picking Indiana County at random, but we have a write-up on each county and what we know about the prisons in that county and resources for families in the individual counties. In addition to that, we started an FAQ section with frequently asked questions that we were getting from families around the Commonwealth. To date, we fielded about 6,000 individual inquiries from worried family members. We think we would have fielded a lot more had we not put up this FAQ section. But for the journalists on this call, if you want to see what the concerns of the families are, what they're really focusing on, you'll find that up here on our FAQ section. And we also started pushing out weekly updates about viral spread and mitigation and other developments in the Commonwealth. As I mentioned, we serve as the ombuds, so we're primarily responding to requests for assistance related to a variety of issues. The number one issue that we were asked to respond to before the pandemic is the same issue that we're asked to respond to now, and that's access to medical care. About a quarter of the requests we receive every month are for people in prison asking for assistance accessing medical care. The keynote speaker spoke about the copay. The copay is alive and well in Pennsylvania. The majority of our counties charge a copay for accessing medical care. Several have suspended the copay during the virus, including our state institutions, which have a $5 copay, have suspended it. But what we are asking our legislators in Harrisburg to do is to ban the copay going forward. I guess the one other thing that I will mention is that, as I mentioned, we primarily serve as an ombuds, but we really wanted to be able to paint a more holistic picture about what life in prison is like and to be able to pinpoint systemic issues. And so, let's see if this is going to let me do this. I think I have to stop my share and then I will start it again. stop share, and then I will start it again. And so starting in April, we sent a survey into all Pennsylvania prisons and jails. And I'm going to get that up here momentarily. And you can find that on our report page. I'm trying to get it up here so I can show it to you, and I may be able to. We have to date received about 2,000 responses to our survey. The majority of those are from people serving time in state facilities. And what we have learned, let's see if I can get that to be full screen, and then I can share it with you. Okay, so you'll see that on our report page at the Prison Society. What our preliminary findings are, we're working on a follow-up, were that by and large in Pennsylvania state prisons, the prisons system was doing what it said it would do. It was getting people access to hand washing. It was keeping people quarantined in their cells. But there were a couple of areas where, let's see, am I allowed to do this? Where we saw that the prison, that what the prison's system was reporting publicly was not what was actually happening behind bars. And that was primarily in two areas. The first was in getting people cleaning products. The second was related, I'm gonna stop this, it's just not working. Stop share. The second was in communicating with people on the inside what was going on. So what we saw was about half of the people who answered our survey reported that they did not feel safe. And whether or not you felt safe was correlated to whether or not the prison was communicating, whether you felt the prison was communicating with you effectively about what was going on. That was in the state system. When we looked at our surveys from the county systems, I'll tell you here in Philadelphia, 98% of our respondents said that they did not feel safe. So compared to Philly, the state system was doing quite well.
That was Claire Schubick-Richards, JD, the executive director of the Pennsylvania Prison Society. She was speaking on a webinar entitled Weighing Public Safety and Public Health that was sponsored by the John Jay College of Criminal Justice's Center on Media, Crime, and Justice as part of its Justice and the Pandemic webinar series. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. I'm Doug McVeigh, and you've been listening to Prison Pipeline. Find this and other installments of Prison Pipeline on the web at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. You'll also find a link there to subscribe to the Prison Pipeline podcast. Prison Pipeline has a Facebook page. It's at facebook.com/prisonpipeline. Please give its page a like and share it with friends. Many thanks to our engineer, and a heartfelt thanks to you, dear listener, for joining us. You make it all worth it. Join us again next week for another edition of Prison Pipeline. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long.
Sometimes
so long.
I find myself alone regretting some little foolish thing, some simple thing that I've done. I'm just a soul. I try so hard.